session number 17747, reel 8.
Were there any aspects of the technical side of your artillery training that made a particular impact on you?
I remember when we first encountered the heavier charges, we had been using mainly charge 1 and charge 2 on our 25-pounders. Charge 1 aimed high, howitzer style, was so innocuous, so that they're deadly to the enemy if he was in the wrong place, so innocuous that you could actually see the shells going. I mean, you could see them coming down after they turned the top of the trajectory, just get a glimpse of them. Charge 2 was a heavier stuff, but when we came to charge 3 and occasionally supercharge, used sparingly because of shortage of ammunition, charge 3 was a deafening noise, and supercharge even more so. And it was the first time, apart from the boys' anti-tank gun it used in practice, it was the first time when we felt really hurt by the noise. We didn't wear earplugs, and the noise was really painful to the eardrums.
Were you advised to put your hands over your ears when the gun fired, or to take any other precautionary measures?
I think we were. Whether we did or not depends on our youthfulness. I think we wanted to see what it was like without. And
More than once?
I can't remember. Probably not if we were sensible.
Do you remember if you did any course on using the guns in the anti-tank role, direct fire?
Yes, we did direct fire, and it using an almost totally flat trajectory. I can't remember much about it, but of course I had a vivid personal experience of it later on when I was fired at by German 88mm in Italy. In that, using that method.
Do you remember what sort of range you would have been expected to achieve if you were engaging armour?
No, I don't, frankly, but I would have guessed up to half a mile, something of that kind.
Would you have used a low charge or a high charge for that sort of engagement?
There again, I can't remember. It's too long ago. It's 55 years today since I joined the army. But I would have thought a high charge would be more reliable.
Giving you a flatter
trajectory. Yes, that's right. I mean, a low charge would sink into the ground before it had got very far. Also, anti-tank work I've got noted on the 5th of March, which makes grand fireworks. Of course, we used tracer shells, so you see exactly where the stuff was going.
What sort of rate of fire could you achieve?
That's a good question. I would have said about 6 rounds a minute, something of that.
And how long would you be able to keep up that sort of rate?
Well, not too long. The interval of 10 seconds would tend to lengthen because these shells are quite heavy to handle. But it could go on if you were already on the right directional accuracy, as long as you didn't have to adjust your elevation or direction, you'd be doing it quite quickly. It was that which would take the time, having to move the director around. And indeed, if it was a long way around, you'd have to move the carriage of the gun.
Were there any particular physical hazards involved in operating the gun, apart from the
noise? No, you had
noise
to keep out of the way of the recoil, otherwise you were dead. I mean, it came right well within the carriage of the gun, the recoil, particularly on the high charges, of course. The use of lanyards for triggering the gun was the official way, but it was rather slower than using the direct trigger mechanism.
Was it the official policy that you should actually stand clear of the
gun
when it was?
Yes, that was the drill, that was the theory.
So presumably the gun layer who was setting the level and setting the direction was supposed to get off his little seat and stand to one side when they...
No, he was to one side already, and he was clear of the recoil. It's the chap who was loading the shells up the spout who was in danger if he didn't get back. This is my memory of it.
Mm. You would have one chap with the shell and one with the charge, wouldn't you? You'd have two loaders.
That's right. And the gun team, I think if I remember rightly, it was six people. There was a sergeant in charge and the gun there and the two on the putting the shells in. And what the other chap was doing, I can't remember, except pulling the lanyard to fire it. It was a full gun team, it was six, though you could do it with less, fewer than six. And of course in troop we had, I had four guns. Eight in a battery, 24 in the regiment.
Do you remember noticing while you were at Alton Towers that there had been any improvements in communications equipment or techniques?
No, I don't remember. Though things were steadily improving all the time as the war went on. In the most rudimentary sense, we had started. Only a year before, I had been on 13 pounders and 18 pounders from the first war. We were now on to 25 pounders. And the radio was getting more manageable, more reliable, lighter. Line communication was no different, I think. Other than that, I remember nothing of detail.
Did you find that as you got towards the end of the Octu, things became easier? Was there a relaxation of pressure as you went on through the course, or did it get more intense?
I think it was deliberately graded to not become physically easier, but I think quite cleverly graded to make you feel more responsible and to aim not at turning you from a yes sir, no sir ranker into an officer overnight, but to make you feel that you were getting there by reasonably steady degrees, eating in more slightly more civilized conditions with waiters, and there was a gradation from being a ranker to being an officer, which I thought was quite well managed. You felt your status gradually growing a bit. It was only 4.5 to 5 months altogether, but this was well handled, I thought. So by the time we came to passing out, the procedure, I can't remember exactly how it went, but we ended up with marching in full officer's uniform without the pip, and went off and sewed the pip on and sort of came back and paraded to the colonel as officers. And that was that. And the most visible, most tangible evidence of the change of status was being, in a bizarre sort of way, was being given first class tickets to go on the train, to leave and go home, post commissioned leave. And that was on the 12th of March 1943, as far as I'm concerned.
Who actually took the passing out parade? Was it the commandant?
Yes, it was the commandant. Mm. Mm.
Do you remember while you were at the Octu having any visitors from outside the establishment? Any senior officers, for example?
No, I don't. I don't remember any generals coming along at all. I dare say that either known or unknown to us at the time, there may have been senior people coming along to inspect the processes. There should have been, even if there weren't, but they probably were.
How long before passing out were you aware that you had actually passed the course and were going to be commissioned? Was there a...
Well, the assumption was that that everybody was going to get through, and it would be a reasonable assumption to make, knowing at the same time that up to 2 or 3 weeks before, people could still be referred back.
They could be RTU'd?
Well, they could be RTU'd in theory, but... More probably put back a fortnight, put back to the following squad. RTUing was pretty rare at this stage. It had been weeded out in the earlier weeks or months.
And presumably the pre-Octu would have filtered out.
And the pre-Octu, of course, had done the real filtering job. Mm. Mm. That's right. We did our ordinary day-to-day work right up to the end. I've got a note in the on the day I was commissioned that we started off with a gun drill.
Would you say that, as a whole, the course was more about training you in skills than it was in assessing you?
Well, to the extent the people referred back, there must have been some degree of assessment. And it is true also that people passed out with grades of suitability. I think I was a B out of four grades. I think there were about two A's in the squad of, say, 24 people, and a few B's, and then a lot of C's. That's how it went. And these grades did follow you to your unit. That I remember. Because somebody, we weren't conscious of it at the time, but I remember being later in a unit where a chap said, well, you know, you ought to be getting your second pip now because you did pass out a B and you haven't done badly. So after 3 months or whatever it was, or 6 months at the most as a second lieutenant, you automatically got your second pip.
Of course, giving A's does tend to give hostages to fortune.
I guess, yes. Although the cases it went to were absolutely outstanding. I mean, there was a regular sergeant who'd made his way up from enlisting as a gunner, who knew everything and had everything, and it would have been a scandal had he not been an A. And I dare say he finished up either a major before the end of the war or dead. He was very good indeed. That's the one I particularly remember.
Do you recall during the training any specific lectures on leadership and man management?
Oh yes, there was a lot of this. Some of it, of course, was taken with more than a grain of salt, particularly by the ex-civilian cadets there, people who had learnt to be sceptical and slightly cynical at universities, were not easy prey, particularly to the major who was a bookmanite, who had was filled with ideas of I forget the phraseology, but it was all sort of trite Reader's Digest stuff about goodness and virtue and everything going to be all right if you follow certain precepts. I mean, it was elementary. I was never a Boy Scout, but I imagine it was Boy Scout sort of stuff, coupled with a strong tinge of American style religion.
Evangelicalism?
Not evangelicalism. I wouldn't have put it as high as that. But
revivalism.
Yes. I mean, it was was it Oxford Movement or Oxford Group, the Buckmanites? A certain straight-lacedness. If you behaved, you would be fine. But all the usual stuff, which is true enough, but comes out, sounds trite when it's enunciated, about courage and uprightness and the other virtues. To be more serious, that's a slightly cynical note. I mean, they did try to instill ideas of which in some cases I must say were fairly necessary, about treating troops like human beings.
Do you remember ever having a discussion about causes of indiscipline and demoralisation and what one should do if you detected demoralisation or discipline, or what might be the causes and cures of mutinous behaviour?
No, I don't. But I think, I mean, this comes back sort of very vaguely through the mists of time. The concept, the sort of unit I was with, and some of the regulars in it had grown up among horses. And the concept that you looked after your horses first was quite strong, and your men came second only to the horses. They should also be looked after. And if you did this sort of thing, all would be well. I mean, it's back to what we were saying a moment ago about treating people like human beings and being firm but fair. No, I don't remember any thoughts of mutiny or disaffection being raised at all. And indeed, I mean, to be fair, that I never encountered them later anyway, so it could have been a waste of time to dwell on them at that stage.
Amongst your instructors, in particular this major you mentioned, did you get the impression that he believed, on the one hand, that leadership is inborn, or on the other hand, that it's something that could be taught and learned?
Well, I think he was, his ideas were relatively democratic. I don't think he was, I don't think he believed in innate. I mean, he wouldn't have been doing this job at Octu, at least I hope he wouldn't, if he hadn't believed that people could be improved, even from having started as gunners or labourers. I mean, he was a fair-minded man, a very good man, some of his ideas grated, but I don't think they were anti-democratic ideas.
He believed in popular virtue.
Yes, helped out by the Almighty.
Would you say that the training you received at Alton Towers was a good preparation for being an officer of your subsequent military career?
Well, I don't know whether I was a good officer, but trying to look at it at the time and since as a potential organiser of such matters, I thought it was fairly well done. I couldn't really fault it.
Was there anything that was left out that you think might have been a distinct improvement to the Octu training? And on the other hand, was there anything that was included that you thought might have been omitted without damage?
I'm not really conscious of anything in either of those directions. I mean, it could have gone on longer. One was conscious, of course, all the time of the pressures of war and the fact that we were going through a sausage machine which was handled as sensitively as was reasonable in those days. That what you were doing was really an encapsulation of a couple of years training into half a year.
But that, of course, was a necessity.
Absolutely, totally, and we understood this. Yes, that's right.
Did you feel confident when you got to the end of the course that you would now be capable of taking command of a troop and organising it and running it?
Up to a point. I mean, you knew theoretically that you were able to do it, but no doubt, like somebody emerging from a teacher training college, you still had to face the class.
Doing the practical.
Doing the thing, and doing it for real.
But, I mean, having been in a troop, even as a trainee,
yes. You
had some notion of the internal social dynamics within a small unit.
That is true, yes. I don't think you could have been prepared much differently, far differently, in theory, but I mean, it is like the difference between doing tactical exercises and being in action, which one may come to later on. There's a huge difference.
How soon before the end of the officer training course did you know where you were going? Did you have a...
Oh, well, that's a question I can answer specifically. I was commissioned on the 12th of March. 9th of March, 3 days earlier, we were given our postings.
Were you asked to indicate any preference? What sort of posting you'd like?
I think we had been. A memory of that sort of comes back faintly. I think we were asked where we would like to go in terms of regions of the country And I opted for the East Midlands because I would be able to see something of my parents and something of any girlfriends from the university, this kind of thing, because I had been at Nottingham. We keenly awaited the postings, and as I say, 3 days before commissioning, I'm to report to the 171 Field Regiment in County Antrim, of all places. What a shock, I put.
Extreme West Midlands, you could call that.
You could call that West Midlands, yes. And on the same evening, it would have been a surprise to be RTU'd at that stage, because we went to collect our uniforms from the tailors in the town.
How did you get to 171 Field Regiment?
You mean physically, by train and boat, via Belfast.
Is this your first visit to?
Indeed it was, yes. I can tell you, if you like, I had a week's leave up to the 21st of March, walked the fields in Lincolnshire, packed Monday morning, 22nd of March, off at 10:45, and met in Manchester a chap from the Potteries, I think it was from the Potteries, certainly Birmingham, if not the Potteries, who was posted to the same unit. Two of us went, a fellow called Jack Lewis. And we had a good dinner in Manchester and went off on the train to Heysham. We eventually got on the boat and found our kit, which had been taken by porters. And we had a wonderfully calm crossing under a full moon. And the next morning we rode for the first time a hansom cab in Belfast. And for the first time, probably ever since before the war, certainly, we had two eggs for breakfast. Ireland was a different country. Rationing was of a different order. We took a train, an Irish train, which was slightly different. I can't remember how. I noted that it was different to Ballymoney. And joining the 171 Field Regiment, I was posted to 151 Battery and had my first experience as an officer in an officer's mess. Felt quite nervous about it, though the colleagues proved very decent. And I'd forgotten this, but I found that we got a small field allowance for being on duty in Northern Ireland, which I'd totally forgotten. And I had a sort of introductory personal drink with the Major Campbell, who was a Scotsman. A number of the officers in the regiment were Scots and Northumbrian, that kind of thing. That was its orientation. I think it was part of 45 Division, Drake's Drum. And so began what proved, in fact, to be 3 or 4 months as a subaltern in Northern Ireland, as a second lieutenant. I don't know what detail you want to go into about that. No doubt it was a fairly common induction period.
What sort of regiment was it? Was it a regular regiment or a territorial yeomanry?
I'm not sure that I know what yeomanry are. Presumably they're sort of county recruited regiments or what?
Well, after the First World War, quite a lot of yeomanry regiments which had been cavalry were turned into signals or field artillery.
I see. Uh-huh.
And they retained a certain cavalry character, although they were actually employed for other purposes.
I don't know whether this was or not. I really don't know. I mean, it was, as far as I was concerned, it was a field regiment like any other. But it did have this slightly regional affiliation, Scotland, north of England.
Was Major Campbell a regular officer?
Jock Campbell. He I thought he was a regular, but I'm not so sure now you come to mention it. He may very well have been a TA. There were an awful lot. I mean, the army was huge at this time, very much bigger than its pre-war equivalents. And one was coming across TA all the time with an admixture of regulars. I do remember that of the, there was the major and there were three captains in the mess, and one of those at least was a regular.
Do you remember what the major said to you when you first met him and had your preliminary interview?
Yes, he said, "Have another." He was a great drinking man. And he also was a chain smoker, and he called cigarettes tubes. "Give me a tube," that I remember. He was a small, hearty sort of chap, but with a colourful turn of phrase if he was crossed. And I remember the sort of mess etiquette touched me for the first time, the fact that you didn't dare to leave dinner until he had stood up, and this kind of thing. I also remember the lavish food, which was something totally new from wartime England, including going out on healthy fresh air exercises and coming back to this this mess where we had not only plum loaf but larded it thickly with butter and so on, and jam. It was a world of good eating.
What was the accommodation?
The accommodation was very interesting. We were in the former fever hospital of the little general hospital in Ballymoney, and the general hospital, which is a fairly newish building, was next door. Ballymoney is a very small market town, and no doubt this hospital served a fairly wide rural area. The fever hospital had been a workhouse and a fever hospital and had been transmogrified into a place with a sizable room for use as a mess, with bedrooms above it. I think we each had our own room. There was no sharing at that point.
What about the rest of the battery, the soldiers and the guns? How were they?
They were dispersed. Being a small place, there was no problem. You could be anywhere within 3 or 4 minutes. And they were scattered around in Nissen huts and other buildings.
Were any of them in billets?
No, they were not in billets, no.
So they're all in official accommodation, as it were?
Yes, they were. And I think there were probably political reasons for that, which I didn't appreciate at the time. Northern Ireland, to us innocents, was still part of a sort of extension of England. In practice, it was not. There was no conscription there, and there was the ever-present neutrality of the Republic of Ireland next door.
And did you notice, as you were settling in and spending your months there, any difference in the atmosphere, the social atmosphere in Antrim compared to that in Lincolnshire, for example?
The most noticeable difference, which would be more apparent to a young man than to older people, was the women. Strangely enough, and this was manifested in the fact that are we still working? As youngsters, our relaxation would be to go to the Saturday night hop in some local hall, and there I encountered something which I've never encountered before or since. And that is that you would go across and invite a pretty-looking girl to have a dance with you. And before you were the second time round the floor, she would say to you, "Are you Catholic or Protestant?" And this, to use the common parlance, I found gobsmacking. I didn't understand why anybody should be interested. It was no more interest to me than asking them whether they voted Labour or Conservative. It seemed totally irrelevant. but not so, as we found out since.
Did your answer have material effect?
I suppose it may have done, but they had learnt some subtlety, and I suppose... I was in an ambiguous position, you see, because although I had been baptised a Catholic, this was because my mother was a Catholic, but my father had been, and still was, he had been until just before the war when he moved. He had been head of a Church of England school, so my own totally ambiguous background made me acceptable, I suppose, to both sides, because I had been accustomed to, when I was a youngster, to going to Mass in the morning, Church of England Sunday School in the afternoon, and with my friends to the Methodist thing in the evening on a Sunday. So I don't know what the term is to cover that, but it was an encyclopedic.
Ecumenical.
Yes, ecumenical, certainly. an ecumenical scepticism I had acquired by this time. And so the prejudices which might have been aroused had I been firmly one side or the other were watered down.
Do you remember if there was any sense of political tension in Ballymoney?
I wasn't aware of it. I dare say it must have been there, but I thought that on the whole...